Yesterday, the president and Benjamin Netanyahu, the president of Israel, released a 20-point plan, a comprehensive plan to end the Gaza conflict. Number one starts out saying the following: Gaza will be a de-radicalized, terror-free zone that does not pose a threat to its neighbors. Number two says Gaza will be redeveloped for the benefit of the people of Gaza, who have suffered more than enough. And later on in the context, it goes on to say that Gaza will not, that Israel will not occupy or annex Gaza. We have been fortunate over the past several months, probably going on to almost a year now, to visit with Colonel Alex Gann, retired colonel and fighter pilot for the Israeli Air Force. He lives in a small village in northern Israel, and he joins us. Colonel, welcome to the show.
Hi, good evening, or good noon to you.
Colonel, it's so good to hear your voice again. We really appreciate you spending time with us. I would assume that this plan has been reported out in Israel. Your thoughts?
Well, of course it has. And yesterday I sat glued to the TV to watch the whole ceremony and the announcements. It's an important moment. It is really maybe the first good chance to end this. It's almost 2-year war, and the most important is to get the hostages back, or whatever is remained from them. Sorry to use this expression. So we're really hopeful, and we were happy that our prime minister has signed the agreement, and now everybody is waiting for Hamas to see what they will do. And my thought is, and my guess is, they will say yes, but. And the question is what the but will be. Will they accept most of the demands? Will they reject them? Will it be something which is acceptable? I don't know. But we have our hopes up for the first time, maybe in 2 years.
You have been very honest and straightforward about your feelings about what's going on, and very critical in many cases of Israel itself, and more importantly, the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Did you think that he would get to this point and agree to this? Because a lot of these provisions in this 20-point plan are really contrary to what he's been talking about, even as late as a week or 10 days ago.
Yes, I agree with you what you're saying. The only one, and I've been saying that for the last year and a half, the only one who could do that is President Trump. Because, you know, I think he's a special character, and sometimes he's unpredicted, and sometimes he can take radical movements. And he's really the only one who could put the pressure on our prime minister. And I'm happy that he came to this stage and is doing it. I don't know for what reasons he's doing it, but I think it's about time. And I think he's doing the right thing by putting the pressure on Bibi Netanyahu. And I think the outcome, if the government in Israel collapses, it's about time. We should have elections a long time ago, and especially end this war. It's unbelievable what's going on, and the country with all the international pressure which is going on in Israel now, some of it is really is out of proportion, but this is a fact. That's where we are, and it's about time it ends, and it's about time we start building our country back again. Now, what we went through for the last 2 years is unbelievable. Actually, the destruction of the value of the country, the state of Israel, not only economically wise, but also morally, is devastating. So it's about time, and we thank, President Trump for that. He can get full credit for me.
Well, Colonel, you've been very honest about that as well. In fact, you predicted many, many months ago that you thought that the only person that could bring this to the forefront and bring some conclusion to this would be the pressure of the United States and, more importantly, the pressure by Donald Trump. The far right has been the impediment to a lot of the compromise that you have advocated for and others have advocated for. What has their reaction been to this 20-point plan?
The far right in Israel is divided, but the majority that you hear from, especially in the government, are the far right. I would say the religious people, and not the Orthodox religious, but the people we call the settlers, the people who will settle in the West Bank, etc. And they had their dream of, occupying Gaza and resettling Gaza with Jewish people, which we haven't been there for I don't know how many thousands of years, which I think is a huge mistake. History sometimes is things that you can dream of, but history is not where you live today. And we're living today, and the Palestinians are not going any place. And you have to, we have to come and settle down with the idea that they're here. And it's very hard to see today that we have peace with them. But at least we have to have some kind of a settlement and some kind of a Pax Romana, as we used to say, some kind of an agreement with them and how we live together. The far right do not represent Israeli population. They're about, I would say, they have today not even 6 or 7% of the population. They may be loud, but we have to put them back in place.
So how would you best describe the reaction of everyone else to this plan?
Well, the majority of the people are happy with it in Israel, because people are tired already. People want to get back to a normal life, to build the economy and to build back the culture. So in Israel, it's about time. And when we look, at the world, we see what's happening in the U.S. The rate of support for Israel is dropping dramatically, especially among the young population. And it's bad. And this attitude toward Israel is mixed in the world with anti-Semitism. And it doesn't matter if it's right or wrong or whatever, it's a fact. And this is something which should have to stop. I think that mainly the European countries are going too far with their attitude. And we hope it will change.
The irony, we're talking about trying to de-radicalize Gaza. In many respects, we have the same challenge here in the United States of de-radicalizing a certain segment of our population. When you talk to them, you've seen it, you watched it on the internet. There's a level of ignorance of the history of, that area of the country and what it means. And I don't know how it got distorted, but it got distorted somewhere along the line.
No doubt about it. I saw yesterday on one of the on the internet an interview, and I think it was on the BBC. And the two people are talking about the conflict in Israel. You know, one of them is pouring a fire and at Israel, and it's terrible what's going on. And the other guy asks him, have you been to Israel? And he says, no. And he says, how can you talk and say what you're saying? You never been there. You never seen anything. He told him, you know, I have been there. I just came back. I was 3 weeks there. I went to Gaza. I talked to people. I was there 16 times. So I know what I'm talking about. How can you talk about something that you never saw? The fact is today that it's so hard to differentiate between truth and lies. And this problem is not leaving us. It's going to become worse and worse with the AI and everything. And people, you know, people are very easy to be deceived, very easy to manipulate them. And it's terrible. It's terrible. Now, the Gazan people, they're not naive. They will not become peace lovers. It will take at least a generation or two. That's why they mentioned even President Trump in his 20 points, he said about the changing the education books, which actually teach little children how to hate Jews and to kill Jews. It's about time that it should be done, but it will take generations. The people in Israel who most believed in a coexistence with the people of Gaza were the people who lived next to Gaza. These were the people who took the people from Gaza to hospitals in Israel, who tried to transfer food and aid, and these are the people who were murdered on the 7th of October. And when you talk to them and you see them now, they say, never again. We'll have to live with them, but we can't believe in them anymore. And that's life.
The hard reality is why Lebanon doesn't want them, Jordan doesn't want them, Syria doesn't want them, the UAE doesn't want them, Egypt doesn't want them, Saudi Arabia doesn't want them, right? I mean,
the country which had a great deal of them is Jordan, and they don't know what to do with them. The Palestinians there are a huge threat to the Kingdom of Jordan. They really don't know what to do with them. They tried once to take over, and Israel saved them in 1970s. They saved the King of Jordan. And we talked about it once, and I said, you know, it's the Palestinians are a nation which are used to living in someone else's expense. They don't make a living. They don't rise and try to build their own economy. It's very sad to say that, but it's a fact. And when they got a lot of money, they build tunnels instead of buildings and schools. So what can we do?
Well, let us hope that Hamas agrees. But I'm not sure that yes, but is going to work. It seems to me that the president and Bibi Netanyahu spoke very clearly yesterday. You accept the 20 provisions of this deal, or there's no deal. And they put a very short time frame, and the clock's running already, right? It says here, item 4, within 72 hours of Israel publicly accepting this agreement, all hostages alive and deceased will be returned. That clock's running right now, because yesterday Israel accepted this agreement.
We hope so. The only ones who can put, further than Trump or Witkoff, did something very clever. When they recruited all the Arab nations 2 days before that, and when they got the agreement of Qatar and Turkey and Indonesia and all these countries and Saudi Arabia, so basically now, if these countries put the pressure on Hamas, especially Qatar, if Qatar tells Hamas, you know, if you don't sign it, we're going to kick you out of Qatar, and Turkey will do the same, they will sign. But if they won't put the pressure on them, then it will be really challenging. We'll, we'll see. We all hope they will sign, and we'll have our fingers crossed. But who knows? Who knows? We hope so. Again, for us, the most important thing is the hostages.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are very thankful, Colonel, that you have made it through, you and your family. We think about you often. You're in my prayers all the time. You know, and hopefully we will pray over the coming hours that Hamas agrees to this deal.
And we hope
so. So that a lot of lives are saved and families in Israel can attempt to put their lives back together, and the Palestinians can do the same.
And we hope so. You know, we hope so.
I got all my fingers and toes crossed, and hopefully prayers will be answered. I don't know what else to do.
You know? Well, that's significant.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Absolutely, Colonel. Thank you so much for joining us. We totally appreciate your time.
And stay
safe, my friend.
Thank you, my friend. Bye bye.
Colonel Alex Gann, retired colonel and fighter pilot for the Israeli Air Force, living in northern Israel. We will be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. When we return, we'll visit with Teresa Campbell, founder and CEO of Safer Schools Together. She was the featured speaker at the 2025 Global Security Exchange. They're in town right now. 15,000 folks, security professionals. She spoke about game changer. Risk is everywhere. We'll talk about that when we return. Folks, Teresa Campbell, founder and CEO of Safer School Together, joins us. She served as the featured game changer speaker at the 2025 Global Security Exchange Convention here in New Orleans. And her keynote address is entitled Risk is Everywhere, Fostering Safety in the Workplace, Schools, and Public Spaces. Teresa, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Teresa, you outlined the most pressing safety challenges there for schools and the workforce. Tell us about those.
I mean, there's multiple challenges that we face, but we are primarily focusing on what we're seeing in really our digital spaces, if you will. So, and our digital use and technology can really be a good thing as long as we know how to embrace it for good. And how do we identify those individuals that might be on the pathway to violence that are giving us pre-indicators on various social media platforms that they're using? So it's imperative, and we're stressing to many people that when we're identifying people of concern, that we're taking the time to take a look at that individual's digital behavioral baseline, also to ensure that they're not connecting with potentially some online nefarious groups that are attempting to radicalize some of our young people.
That digital world is every bit as dangerous, right, as the physical construct of a school, a workplace, or public spaces. And obviously, a lot of what happens at the physical construct is actually forecasted in the digital arena, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really what we're trying to have people embrace. You know, the concept of leakage has been around since 2000. Dr. Mary Ellen O'Toole from the FBI, then we were looking at mass tragedies and killers. The one commonality that we saw then was the fact that there was leakage prior to these attacks. Now, good news or bad news, however we may look at it, we're now faced with digital leakage, which means we're seeing more of it. But we need to be able to equip our not just our school teams, but all safety professionals in being able to look into our digital space to identify individuals that are engaging in behaviors that could be very worrisome or cause violence in some communities.
What commonalities do you see out there that kind of reveal themselves that people should be aware of and say, whoa, wait a minute?
Yeah, I think, you know, unfortunately right now, even given the context of the last few weeks, you know, we're well aware, we're looking at a lot of threat-related behavior online. But what's really important to recognize is even though we're being exposed and hearing about a number of threats that are being made, the good news is that there's very few individuals that are making those threats that are also engaging in behaviors consistent with those threats. So it's really important that as individuals hear others, it doesn't matter if an individual is 6 or 56, ethics. We want people to be recognizing when somebody's potential behavioral baseline might be changing and things just don't seem right. And they are also talking about an essential amount of time that they're starting to spend on a certain specific social media platform. Where are they spending that time? And who are they talking to when they're there?
You know, I was an elected sheriff for 10 years, and I used to tell parents all the time, be intrusive. Go look in your kid's room. My kids couldn't lock their door. They had passage locks. I wouldn't allow
Love
them
it.
To lock.
Love it.
And, you know, and I would go snoop. I mean, yep. I would assume in the digital arena, that's still good advice.
Absolutely. I mean, I love what you just said there. I mean, this is a time where, you know, our kids have had the advantage of knowing more than what we know when it comes to technology. So there's never been a better time now for parents to be very much engaged in exactly what their kids are doing online, but more importantly, who they're doing it online with. One of our most significant concerns right now for young people, which is why it's a real-time call-out for parents, is right now we have very popular games like Roblox and Minecraft, but we've got some nefarious, I'm going to call them nefarious, I'm not going to name them, but these comm network type groups that are targeting kids in the Roblox and Minecraft area, encouraging them, telling them how to disable the parental controls. Then they coax them over to an encrypted one-to-one platform like Discord, where they then start engaging with them to provide sexual images. A case I saw last week was when they were encouraging an individual to self-harm online while they watched. The other pieces that we're continuing to see is some of these networks that are also encouraging young people to hurt a sibling on camera or hurt a family animal. And in some more recent cases, we're actually seeing individuals from these remote online networks that are encouraging these young people to engage in high-profile acts of violence.
Unfortunately, it's just far too easy to pique the curiosity of adolescents, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they're curious, and you know, we want our kids to be safe both physically, but we also want them to be feeling safe online. And I think it's just imperative, regardless of the age of your child, that we're having those conversations about exactly, you know, what are they doing online, where are they going online, and most importantly, I think we have to be prepared as parents to recognize any sudden behavioral baseline changes in our own kids. They're starting to spend more time online. Let's be inquisitive. Let's ask the question. That's almost become a detective of disconnectedness if we are observing disconnectedness with our own kids, but they're connected online.
At one time, there was popular software to put on devices of children where parents could monitor. Is it still available, and is it up to snuff?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a couple that are still available. I think the challenge that we have, and that we're going to continue to have it, is because our kids are smart. Our kids are starting to use other devices, friends' devices. So really, regardless what I may have done as a parent for my daughter, it doesn't really impact her behaviors when she's using somebody else's device when she's at their residence. So it really does have to come back to those global conversations we're having with our kids around if they're getting devices, what are they using it for? What are they not going to use it for? What are they going to do when they're asked to do something that they don't feel good about doing? Because they will be asked. What are they going to do when they're sent the nude pic? Because they are going to be sent a nude pic. And making sure that we have those plans in place beforehand. And of course, you know, worst case scenario that we're seeing more and more of because of some of these nefarious groups online, we've got to have the conversation as much as we're telling our kids not to be sharing intimate images online. Heaven forbid that they do, and somebody else gets a hold of them. They begin to become extorted. Sometimes those kids can't face their parents to let them know what's happened. So we've got to break down that barrier as well to make our kids know as much as we want you to make good decisions. If something like this happens, and let's call it what it is, please make sure that you let us know.
Yeah, it gets back to really knowing the freedoms of their friends, too, how much freedom their friends enjoy and gaining a better understanding of that. I mean, a lot of this hasn't changed over the years. It's just the threats are greater.
the behaviors have not changed at all. But the threats and the risks that exist today online, unfortunately, they're very different. My daughter's 25. They're very different than what she faced as an 18 and 19-year-old. And, you know, some of our most vulnerable kids and some of our kids that are feeling isolated in our physical settings, unfortunately, they go to a place where all of a sudden they're feeling a sense of connection. But many of those connections can be very, very harmful.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I know the challenges of law enforcement has increased tenfold. But I'm encouraged because I think folks like yourself and the private sector working closer with government and law enforcement, because, you know, the private sector is so much more advanced than we were in government. It's really worked well from an enforcement perspective. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And honestly, the best partnerships for everything we've just described are the partnerships that exist day in and day out between our schools and our local law enforcement agencies. They do a phenomenal job. They're the first ones to sign up for our training. How do we identify these behaviors, and then what do we do with them? You know, when they're dealing with school shooting threats on Snapchat and some of the other platforms, you know, they're the ones that have to respond because they're getting the calls at school. So again, their role in being the primary partners in prevention with our parents is crucial.
In my role as a talk show host, I watch a lot of video of a lot of school boards and how they react to some of the contemporary issues. Are they, for the most part, on top of this issue, or is there still reluctance in some corners? I think we may have lost Teresa Campbell. We'll take a break. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We'll try and reconnect. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Folks, we're back with Teresa Campbell, founder and CEO of Safer Schools Together. We've been talking about the digital landscape and the challenges for kids. Before we got disconnected, Teresa, I was asking, I look at a lot of videos of school board meetings across the country. They get pretty volatile. Kind of curious, are they buying into the your messaging relative to the threats and how best to deal with that or not?
Yeah, I've got to say, I mean, we've seen a significant shift in the overall buy-in, I'd have to say, over the course of the last 3 years, maybe even coming from the pandemic, when we think about the time we shifted all of our learners to being online, and we started to recognize the challenges that they are facing in schools upon the return. So I would say in the last 2 to 3 years, overall, school boards are embracing the fact that we need to do more when it comes to both behavioral and digital threat assessment in schools.
What are some of the most pressing issues that you're seeing in the digital spectrum on schools? Is it, I mean, I know they're utilizing it as a tool for bullying and other things.
Yeah.
Are there other issues that you're seeing?
I think the most significant is probably what all of us have seen, especially over the course of this last year, is school shooting threats. And of course, you know, the number of threats that school districts are seeing is up by over 60%. And that's across the board. It wouldn't matter what state we were in. And that's real time and time in the classroom that's being lost, when in some cases, if they don't know how to assess and respond to a TikTok or Snapchat threat, some cases they make the decision to close school the next day. So they know that they need to make better and informed decisions. So the school teams with the SROs, we do a lot of work with the National Association of School Resource Officers as well. It's critical in 2025 that every school district and SRO associated schools has a plan and knows how to assess and respond to those online threats that they're facing. Threats today in our schools are now over 90% digital, as opposed to 25 years ago when we were dealing with more of the traditional bullying on the schoolyard or a fight on the soccer field where I'm going to kill you tomorrow. That whole playground of and landscape of threats has completely changed. So we have to have the tools and resources to assess and respond appropriately.
Just got an alert on the news that Southern University campus is on lockdown because of threats. I mean, we get this far too much in this country today.
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I was just speaking to that in my session earlier, is that we're seeing some of these network online groups that have taken claim, if you will, for being responsible for some of the swatting incidents at one of our campuses. And so hopefully this one that you're referring to, I haven't seen it come up on my alert yet, hoping is just that, and nobody is in harm's way. But it is imperative that we become more informed with these groups and also what their intent is to do in our communities.
I know you were at GSX today delivering your thoughts. How did they receive it, and what are you hearing from the security professionals around the world?
I think everybody is on the exact same page when we're all recognizing the role of technology and how do we leverage, if you will, digital leakage for good, right? A lot of us see some of the technology and digital behaviors as really being a major challenge. But the reality is, again, with good partnerships with our law enforcement agencies and for everyone being trained in behavioral threat assessment and management, which we're seeing more and more states mandate that training in communities, they recognize that what we're looking for is digital leakage that kind of gives us the head start that somebody's on that pathway to violence. And I can personally say, having been involved in many, many different cases, it sure feels much better identifying somebody on that pathway prior to them engaging in active violence to when we're dealing with the aftermath of an incident of violence.
We've spent a lot of time talking about schools. Let's pivot real quick in the minutes that we have left about the workplace. Millions upon millions of dollars are spent by private corporations trying to make those places safe. Are the challenges for the most part the same? Are there some unique to the workplace that you can identify?
No, human behavior is human behavior. And as much as we might be aware of different behaviors we might see in a five-year-old versus a 55-year-old, at the end of the day, somebody to engage in an act of violence, serious violence, is an evolutionary process, which means nobody just snaps. And so we recognize that in all of our organizations, we've got to be doing a better job. You hear a lot of people talking about red flags or early warning systems. We've got to do a better job of recognizing worrisome behaviors in others. And I don't care if it's in schools, our higher ed campuses, or in our workplace, because typically 95% of the cases in the aftermath of an incident of violence, we do find out later, oh, I did recognize that he or she's been acting differently lately. But who did you report that to? So one of my messages today was, one of the things we can do across the board in all of our organizations and schools is make sure that everybody can identify what worrisome behavior is. And for the most part, it's just when there's a change in what somebody's typical behavioral baseline is, and who are they reporting it to? Because too often, as I said, in completed homicides and suicides, we're finding out after the fact that somebody posted something or said something to somebody, but they just didn't know what to do with that information.
You know, identification and reporting obviously is incredibly important. I always found that, you know, organizations really lack the ability to receive the information. And to me, that's every bit as important. Just wanted to hear your reaction.
Yeah, and again, I think that's one of the reasons we've seen such success with, as much as we want to encourage a culture and climate in all of our organizations of people being able to report physically and personally, the reality is we've seen over the course of the last 3 to 5 years the success of well-implemented anonymous reporting tools. You know, many of us maybe don't think much of the see something, say something, but we've really seen the success even over the course of the last 4 weeks where we've got family members that are, you know, reporting very concerning behaviors of another family member that they're worried that they're going to be engaged in a mass incident of violence. So, you know, we are seeing some success with the anonymous reporting tools. I think we can do a little bit better with those reporting tools. When you talk to people and when I ask them why they didn't use a reporting tool, they typically say, well, we didn't think they would do anything. So I challenge everybody to change the see something, say something, but to add the last line of, and we will do something.
Yeah, it's amazing how simple it can get, right? I mean, it's, you know, when you're, you know, common sense still prevails in so many different ways.
Absolutely, absolutely. I said we can talk about worrisome behavior in every organization. It's all free. We can do it for free. We don't need to get funding. We don't need to go for different approvals. We can all start doing it today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. We really appreciate only your time, but your insight, and the role that you play is incredibly important. And thank you for visiting our great city.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Take care.
Thank you. That's Teresa Campbell, founder and CEO of Safer Schools Together. We'll be right back. We'll check in with Scoot. Stay with us. So I hope you enjoyed our conversation, not only with Teresa Campbell, but Colonel Alex Gann. The Colonel, I really enjoyed visiting with him and speaking with him about these issues in Israel. And I wanted to read Provision 9 to you of the 20 points outlined in the Comprehensive Plan to End the Gaza Conflict. And it reads as follows. Gaza will be governed under the temporary transitional governance of a technocratic, apolitical Palestinian committee responsible for delivering the day-to-day running of public services and municipalities for the people in Gaza. This committee will be made up of qualified Palestinians and international experts with oversight and supervision by a new international transitional body, the Board of Peace, which will be headed and chaired by the President Donald Trump, with other members and heads of state to be announced, including former Prime Minister Tony Blair. This body will set the framework and handle the funding for the redevelopment of Gaza until such time as the Palestinian Authority has completed its reform program as outlined in various proposals, including President Trump's peace plan in 2020 and the Saudi-French proposal, and can securely and effectively take back control of Gaza. The body will call on the best international standards to create modern and efficient governance that serves the people of Gaza and is conducive to attracting its investment. Very important language, and hopefully keep your fingers crossed that Hamas signs on. Scoot joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
We are going to talk about early voting, Scoot. And we're going to talk about being a gentleman in New Orleans.